Whenever God created the world, he created it like an intricate spider's web with everything connected to him. And then when Adam and Eve sinned, they cut that tether and the spider's web of life started to collapse in on itself. And then man tries to reconnect the tether, but he always tries to reconnect it to the wrong things. Isn't that right? Money, wealth, happiness, pleasure, whatever, possessions, work. And Solomon sets out to show in the opening chapters that man is choosing the wrong things to anchor his life to. And then he sets out in the following chapters to show that God is sovereign. And then in the closing chapters to show the wisdom of connecting, reconnecting our lives to God. So we're going to read this morning from chapter 5. It's from chapter 5, verse 8. And one of the things you'll note as we go through it, every time, it depends what version you're using. If you're using the NIV, the phrase meaninglessness or meaningless, it comes up many times in Ecclesiastes. The NIV and many translations translate the one Hebrew word the same way right the way through. It has different shades, different hints and tints of meaning. And as we read through it, I'll seek to change it just to give you the flavour that it has in its context. So we start at verse 8 of Ecclesiastes chapter 5. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is wasted effort. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner, except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of the labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune. So that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as soon as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain? Since he toils for the wind. All his days he eats in darkness, with great frustration, affliction and anger. Then I realised that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him. For this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He does not revisit or focus on the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions and honour, so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is perplexing. A grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet, no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes unknown. It departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over. but fails to enjoy his prosperity. Do not all go to the same place? All man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. What advantage has a wise man over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than a roving of the appetite. This too is wasted effort, a chasing after the wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and fleeting days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? When I was thinking about what to speak on, I didn't pick this passage because I was under the impression that the people in Killikameen Evangelical Church are extremely rich and need to be given a talk on money. You may well be, but that's not why I'm looking at it. This passage, the passage we're looking at this evening, deal with two contrasting sides of living the Christian life. Living when things are going well for us, and living when things are going hard for us. And this is really our theme this morning, displaying, or even if you're not a Christian, seeing that Jesus is great above all other things. So it's seeing and displaying that Jesus is great when things are going well and when things are going hard for us. That's what we'll be looking at this evening, when things are going hard. And so, although Solomon's talking primarily about wealth, his teaching can be applied to possessions, to doing well, to all sorts of aspects that when things are going well for us, are covered by this. Arnold Schwarzenegger once said that money doesn't make you happy. He said, I now have 50 million and I'm as happy as I was when I had 48 million. And perhaps we're not exactly as rich as that or anywhere near it. Yet the idea of having just a little more, of being a little bit more well off, or having just something extra, is something that we can all struggle with. Perhaps we're like the figure Tevyev from Fiddler on the Roof. It's one of my favourite musicals. And at one point he says, Dear God, you made many, many poor people. I realise, of course, it is no shame to be poor, but it's no great honour either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? And sometimes we can feel a little, what, Lord? A little more. Just make it a little easier. And yet, here we are here in the western part of the world, and we're far richer than 90% of the rest of the world. And how are we to live when things are going well for us? Solomon is a man who knows what it is to be filthy rich. He knows what it's like to be so rich you can't even begin to count it. His annual income was somewhere in the region at today's price of £200 million pounds sterling. And that doesn't include the revenue from merchants and traders and from the Arabian kings and governors, we're told in 1 Kings 10. His drinking cups were made of gold. His house was so colossal that it took 13 years to build. He had a mighty workforce, so it wasn't because he was working at it himself. This man knows all about wealth, and here in the sunset years of his life, as he looks for something vital to communicate to the next generation, he comes to tell them some key truths. In the first 7 verses of chapter 5, he deals with religion, the religion of some, in other words, worshipping God. And now he turns to the religion of many, their possessions and their wealth. And as he looks back in old age, he's looking for what gives profit and meaning in life. And he teaches us about this. And what he teaches can be divided into 3 main points. And we're going to spend the bulk of the time on the third point. So we're going to move swiftly through the first 2. The first one is this. Money isn't the issue. Or wealth isn't the issue. Or possessions aren't the issue. God is. God is the issue. Is it wrong for a Christian to have a lot of possessions and money? Is it wrong for Solomon to be rich? Solomon never condemns wealth. And how could he? Because God, 1 Kings 3:13, said, I will give you riches and honour. And here in verse 19, he says, moreover, when God gives any man wealth, it's God who gives wealth and possessions. As far as the Bible is concerned, money isn't the issue. It's our relationship to God that's key. And the real issue is not money, but righteousness and godliness. And in a sense, there's four categories of people in the world, not two, the rich and the poor. There's four categories. There's the godly rich. They're people who have worked hard, become wealthy, or become wealthy through inheritance, but they serve God with their wealth. See examples in the Bible. Job, Joseph of Arimathea. We see a second category of people. And Solomon deals with three of these categories in the passage. There's the godly rich, there's the ungodly rich. Those who have become rich through sinful means and or spend their money in a sinful way. And these can be, a Christian can fall into that category, can't they? They can have lots of money, but they can choose to use it in a way that doesn't honour God. Or a highly religious person like the rich young ruler can be morally upright and yet make an idol of his money, and he falls into the category of the ungodly rich. Then there's the godly poor. Those who serve God with their what little they have, perhaps they're less well off because of their faith. And they've chosen not to accept a particular job because it would compromise their beliefs. And they fit into the category of the godly poor. And then there's the ungodly poor. People who are of no money because they don't work or don't spend wisely or don't tithe to God. And Proverbs speaks a lot about the sluggard and about people not eating if they don't work. Solomon deals with three of these four categories. In verses 8 to 17, he deals with the unrighteous rich man or the ungodly rich man. Verse 12, he deals with the righteous poor man. And then he deals with the godly or the righteous rich man. So it's not about money. God isn't interested so much in our bank balance as in our heart's attitude to our bank balance or our possessions or when things are going well for us. What's our heart attitude? And this is Solomon's issue for us. All through this book, Solomon has been asking the question, what's life about? And as we've seen in the, or rather, as you will see if you look at the opening chapters, in chapters 1 and 2, he shows us that if you take anything and elevate it into the position of God, you will face ultimate frustration and disappointment because no thing can take the place of God. And the question comes to us this morning, is money or possessions or life going well for you, prosperity, whatever form it takes, a big issue for you in your life? Or is God the big issue? If for Solomon, the issue is our attitude to God, not our possessions. What is the attitude that you have? Or to put it another way, where do you find your satisfaction? What would satisfy you more, the prospect of being handed $2,000 when you come in the door every week by your minister? Or the prospect of your minister standing preaching and God feeding you through his word, rich and deep truths from his word, and those truths sinking in? Where does your satisfaction lie? That brings us to the second thing that we see here. Solomon wants to convey to us, if wealth, doing well, prospering, or possessions is your God, it will frustrate you. It'll frustrate you. Solomon sets out to show us in these verses that prosperity, wealth, doing well is as satisfying as a mirage in the desert. For many of us, we perhaps have a little corner in our hearts that says, if only I had a little more, it would be enough. Few of us will ever have the wealth that Solomon had. to realise how empty it leaves us. So Solomon writes to tell us how empty wealth and the latest gadgetry and all of these things can be. And he shows us, I want to briefly show you these eight things. Look at these verses, verse 8 and 9. Wealth corrupts, or prosperity often corrupts. He speaks in these verses about the poor being oppressed, one man over another, the other trying to buy off, and the king over them all still. The more a person gets, the more they want, and they resort to unjust means. Then we find that wealth makes people hungrier for more. Verse 10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. And it becomes a vicious cycle. You want money, so you work hard to get it. And you work to eat, and then you eat to work. And you get up the next day and you go to work. And then you come home and you eat and then sleep so you can go to work. And you just keep doing and caught up in this endless cycle. Hungrier for more. Wealth then brings on the Klingons. Solomon tells us in verse 11. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. We see it with celebrities. They've got money, and then all these people sort of appear out of nowhere. All the aunts, uncles, second cousins, third cousins appear. How wearisome. And then wealth, we find in verse 11, will ultimately bore the person who has it. As goods increase, so do those. What benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on? You can only use so many things. You can only wear so many outfits. Only wear one at a time, in fact. The rest are just there to look at. Wealth bores us. Prosperity can bore us. Wealth brings anxiety. Verse 12. The second half of it, he's not able to sleep, he's got so much. William Burrell, the man who donated his art collection to the city of Glasgow, was a recluse in his later years and stayed in his castle because he was afraid that someone would either steal his art collection or that it would burn down. Brings its own anxiety. Wealth is easily lost. When I preached this sermon in Donegal, it was the very week that Smart Telecom took a nosedive and their shares dropped from €27 to €3 a share. Wealth can be lost just as easily as that. And how can wealth be an answer in life, or prosperity, or something we can pin our hopes on when it can so easily vanish? Why should we invest hope in something that can disappear so quickly? And already, those of you who know Jesus can start to see the contrast, can't you? You can start to see the contrast. If wealth is your God, it'll frustrate you. And in verse 16, Solomon asks a question that occurs throughout Ecclesiastes. What does he gain? Or what profit, when all is said and done, come the end of life, and you weigh up everything, and all the pluses, all the minuses, what is left over at the end of life? What profit is this to? Now, the millionaire travelling in executive class, and the beggar stowed away in the undercarriage of the plane, when the plane crashes, both stand with nought on before God. No credit cards or bank balances don't matter. What profit is it to have been rich or poor? Wealth, we see in verse 17, brings loneliness. This is Solomon speaking of his own experience, sitting there surrounded by things, bitter and angry because he's been surrounded by spongers. He's hidden himself away. And then wealth doesn't guarantee enjoyment. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 6. Here's the ultimate sadness. Robbie Williams, the pop star, I heard him say in a radio interview once, he says, I wanted such and such, and when I got it, I thought I would be happy, but I'm not. It doesn't bring happiness. It doesn't guarantee enjoyment. Wealth is like going into McDonald's. And you look at the menu and there's this massive picture of a gigantic burger. And you think, oh, I'll have that. And it comes to you and it's in a little box. And you think, there's something wrong here. And you open the box and there's this little limp burger. And it looks nothing like what was on. That's wealth. That's prosperity. That's Solomon's comprehensive survey of wealth. Money can't satisfy. It lets us down. It only buys distractions and not answers. And God has built in. This is Ecclesiastes reveals how much God has built into life. He's built in dissatisfaction into wealth and possessions. That's just the way it is. We aren't ever going to find fulfillment there. That's what verse 10 of chapter 6 is saying. Whatever exists has already been named. What man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is strong. God has decided how things are going to be, and that's it. Wealth is designed to be dissatisfying. Why is that? Because only God will satisfy us. And that's our main point, our final point, although we'll spend a bit more unpacking it. If God is your God, He will satisfy you. Solomon has been asking this question throughout the book. Where do you find your satisfaction? Where are you looking for satisfaction? And he's showing us in these verses the futility of wealth and possessions and prosperity. But he then says, if God is your God, He will satisfy. C.S. Lewis said that God whispers to us in our pleasures. And that speaks to us in His providence and shouts at us in our pain. But He whispers to us in our pleasures, in our possessions. These things are meant to make us think of the giver. Why is it you're sitting here, called whatever you're called, and you're not called a Brafo when you're sitting in a mud hut in Somalia? Why is it? Because you deserve to be here? Because you've earned the right to be? Because God is sovereign, He's put you here. And the goal of these things is to make us think not about them, but about the giver. We're to think about the one who provides. And it's only when you make God your goal that you find the freedom to enjoy what you have. Whether it's little, as verse 12, the first part would seem to indicate, the sleep of the laborer is sweet. Whether he eats little or much, he's a poor man out digging ditches for somebody else. He comes home and he has a home and has a potato to eat. Or maybe he has steak to eat. But he sleeps well. This is the point of the contrast in this passage. Between verses 18 to 20 of chapter 5 and verses 1 to 2 of chapter 6. There's a man in 18 to 20 who has things and enjoys them. There's a man in chapter 6 verses 1 and 2 who has things and doesn't enjoy them. Life's a drudge for him. What makes the difference? God gives the gift of enjoyment to one and not the other. And why is it that God gives the gift of enjoyment to one and not the other? Why does God enable one man to enjoy his life and the other to be consumed with greed? Is it because God is spiteful? The answer isn't in Ecclesiastes. Not in this passage. Solomon expects us to remember what he said earlier. Ecclesiastes 2:26, to the man who pleases him, God gives happiness. Expects us to remember what he wrote in Psalm 127. He, God, gives his beloved sleep. God gives the gifts of contentment and enjoyment to those who make him their treasure, who make him their number one, their goal, who find their satisfaction in him. This is what I want us to come to this morning. Is this challenge. If we are going to live in this world, whether we're well off or whether we're not well off, we want to make Jesus our treasure. Not our state of well-being, not our possessions, not our wealth. So here, we're to make Jesus your treasure, not possessions. That's what Solomon is getting at. Make God your treasure. Because there's no lasting, meaningful profit in wealth. As you come, verse 16, so you depart. With nothing in hand. You know, you walk into an investment broker's and you say, I'm going to invest all I have. What return will I get? The best we can give you is nothing. Great. I'll go somewhere else. And yet that's what people do. And people, they look at the low yield, low return, low interest of the things of this life. They say, I'm going to invest my life in these, and at the end they come out with nothing. And that's what Solomon is calling us to do. He's calling you and me to invest our lives in the high interest, high return, high yield of following Jesus, of pouring our lives into Jesus, of making Jesus our treasure, not anything else, not our possessions, not our car, not our wages, not our state of well-being, not how well we're doing in this world. You know, we can only take one of two things with us when we go. One of those is our record, and the other of those is our relationship with Jesus. If you've got a relationship with Jesus, you don't have a bad record. If you don't have a relationship with Jesus, all you've got is a bad record. You can't take anything else with you. And we need to make Jesus our treasure, not things, because Jesus is the only one who can deal with our bad record and make us right with God. In a sense, isn't it true that we're not greedy enough? We're not greedy enough. God offers us pleasures at His right hand forevermore. And we say often, no, I'd rather have a few pennies. Now. So here comes Solomon's challenge to make Jesus your treasure. Maybe some of you here this morning aren't yet putting your trust in Jesus. You've been coming to church, but you're not a Christian, as the Bible describes it. And what you need to do now is to ask Him to rewire, reconfigure, reprogram your heart so that Jesus is now important to you. And you need to apologize to Him for treating Him like nothing whenever He's everything. And you need to ask Him to enable you to delight in Him and to enjoy Him and to turn your life round so that you'll follow Him. You know, because verses 1 and 2 paint a very bleak picture, and then 3, 4, 5 and 6 paint a very bleak picture of what it is like to have things but not of Jesus. Solomon says it's better if you weren't born. It's better if even you were miscarried and didn't see the light of day. See, that's the point of making Jesus your treasure and not possessions. Not well-being, not how well you're doing in this life. If you do that, you have eternal life. But not only that, the challenge comes to those of you then who have made Jesus your treasure and given your life to Christ. It's not just something you do once. But the second challenge, first is make Jesus your treasure, not possessions. The second challenge is live contented so that people will see that Jesus is your treasure. Live contented so that people will see that Jesus is your treasure. That Jesus matters to you. That your satisfaction and happiness isn't in having the latest this or the nicest that. You know, for those of you who are gadget freaks like me, you might have been watching Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, displaying the new iPhone and all its stunning technological advancement. Yeah, I love one of those. Or maybe you've been looking at a car and thinking, I like that. Or maybe you've been pursuing promotion. Not that there's anything wrong in pursuing promotion or buying a new car or any of these things, but it's when they become the be-all and end-all of life, so that the minute they come out, we get one, or we're like everybody else, and people look at us and they can't see that we are content with what Jesus has given us. That then becomes the problem. Because people should see in us that we are content with what God has given to us. Solomon shows us that here in these verses. He speaks it in verse 13 to 15 of things that just, they go. So what should be the Christian's attitude to wealth that just goes? We should hold it loosely, shouldn't we? You know, there's two things in life that we can do. There's things that are vital that we have to hold in a tight grip, and there are things that we need to keep in an open hand, things that can come and go. The Christian needs to have the relationship with Jesus in the tight grip. And everything else, possessions, salary, all of those things, even our health, we're in the open hand. So that people can see that we're content because we've got Jesus, not because we've got any of these things. And the danger is if you hold something that should be in this hand, and God tries to take it away. You ever tried to take something off your children and they're holding on tight? It hurts them to let go, doesn't it? And whose fault is it? It's their fault because they're holding on so tight. We should hold loosely to the things that aren't vital to us. And doing that will let people see that Jesus is our treasure. Solomon also says to us in chapter 6, verse 9, be content with what you have. Better what you have than what you don't. And God in His wisdom and in His sovereignty and in His love has given you exactly what you need. So why should we be trying to keep up with others? Our God has given us what we need. A wealthy businessman, he was in the Bahamas, he's on holiday, he was disturbed to find a fisherman sitting with his feet up on the dock. And he says to him, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I've caught enough fish for today." And the businessman said, "Look, why don't you catch more fish than you need? And then what you could do is you could sell off the excess and buy another boat, and eventually you could build up a bigger fleet and you could make more." Guy said, "Well, what would you do?" "So, well, you would earn more money and you would be able to have such a fleet that in a few years you could retire early and sell off your fleet and make a complete fortune." Fisherman said, "What would I do then?" "Well, you could sit down and enjoy life." Said the businessman, "Take it easy." Fisherman looked at him and said, "What do you think I'm doing now?" We need to learn to be content with what God has given us, trusting in our Heavenly Father so that people can see that that's where our trust lies. Solomon outlines another way we can do that. Chapter 5, verses 18 and 19, he speaks about enjoying. It is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun. It is good to do this. You know, I go and preach in some places and I see the most miserable looking people I've ever seen in my life. You know who they are? Christians. You know, have you ever seen them? You know, I think, hold on a minute. If God made a perfect world in the Garden of Eden and we're being restored to that bit by bit, surely Christians should be the people who are enjoying life the most. And look at the faces of some of them. There's these lines in it where they haven't smiled for half a century. And yet when you read Ecclesiastes, Solomon commands, chapter 11, there's four commands, and one of them is enjoy. And throughout the book, enjoy. Enjoy. Whether you eat or drink, he's saying, you know, he says, whatever it is, enjoy it. And it's not so different from what Paul says in 1 Corinthians. Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it to the glory of God. That's the New Testament equivalent of what Solomon is saying. God gives us what we need. If God is our God, if we find our satisfaction in God, we should be able to sit down to the simple things in life and show that we delight in them and enjoy them. This is a great theme of Ecclesiastes. We're free not to get caught up in the rat race. We're free to take time to enjoy life and family. We're free to spend time serving others. Why? Because we know our Father will provide. And in the midst of the toil, talks here about the toil, we're delighting and putting Jesus as our treasure, and we're seeking to enjoy the things he's given to us, we'll find laughter, we'll find peace, we'll find contentment. And people will see that and say, "What is it you've got?" And what is it we've got? We've got Jesus. And we're displaying to them that Jesus is great. I have a friend at Christmas time, the place he works in, part-time, came to him and said, "Look, we want you to come to the Christmas do." He said, "No, I don't really want to come." And he said, "No, you've got to come." And he insisted that he come, and he was asking me, "Mark, what should I do?" I said, "I don't really enjoy it, because they all get blind drunk, and I don't enjoy that." I said, "Well, why do they insist that you come?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "I'll tell you why, because they told me of last year's Christmas and the year before. And he was the life and soul of it. Not because he got blind drunk, but because he just was there and he brings a sense of fun everywhere he goes and he enjoys life." And these guys who weren't Christians wanted him there because he brought a sense of fun. They knew where he stood about Christian things. And there was something about him that they wanted him there. And the Christian is called to be like a candle. We're called to give off such a light that people, and such a joy that people want to be near us. We're called to give off such a heat that at the same time they want to stay back a wee bit. And it's that light and heat that we're to do. And part of that light that's attractive and that pulls people in is seen in our enjoyment of life. Because if King Jesus is really restoring you and I to what the Garden of Eden was like. Can you imagine, were there long faces in the Garden of Eden? Not at all. There was delight, there was joy. This is Solomon's theme here. that we should enjoy what God gives, so that people can see that Jesus, amidst the trials, the pain, the hardship of life, that these people are satisfied in something beyond life. So we're to enjoy what God gives. We're to be content in a God who provides for our needs. That's what verse 20 of chapter 5 is saying. He seldom reflects or revisits the days of his life. The Christian isn't someone sitting, harking back over the painful memories of the past, becoming increasingly bitter. There's someone whose their treasure is in Jesus the Son. And when that's the case, God the Father brings us into his family. That means when we grasp this, the anxiety goes. We know that he knows best for us. And we're free to enjoy today, because we don't need to worry about yesterday or tomorrow. Perhaps we struggle because we're not content to leave things in God's hands. And then people just see that we're like everybody else. And they're worried about their kids. And they're worried about their pension. And they're worried about how they're going to cope. And they're worried about what will happen. And there's the Christian. And they're worried about their kids. And they're worried. And they're worried. That's why Jesus said, so do not worry. Saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? What shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things. And your heavenly Father knows that you need them. And what does he say? But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. What's that? That's just another way of saying treasure God. Treasure Jesus. Make Jesus your possession. Your treasure. Not your possessions. Make Jesus your treasure. And all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore do not worry about tomorrow. For tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. We're to be content in a God who will provide for our needs. So that people will say, what is it about you? Life's going hard for you, and yet there's a peace about you. Aye, but I have a Heavenly Father that I know will provide. How do you know? Well, he provided his Son. If he provided the greatest, will he not provide all the other things I need? And then finally, we're to use our possessions to show that Jesus is our treasure. We're to use our possessions to show that Jesus is our treasure. Somebody said money is like manure. You pile it up in one place, it stinks. You spread it out and it does a lot of good. And they're right. What is your great desire? Isn't it that others would see that Jesus means everything to us? And how can we do that? We're to live in such a way that when they look at us, they see not the same hunger for possessions, not the same hunger for income, not the same hunger for promotion just to get a bigger salary. What does that say about where our treasure is? People need to see that God is our joy, that God is our satisfaction. When the things go wrong and we're demoted, or we lose our job, or we lose our health and aren't able to work, that our first port of call is God, and that our delight is in God. Or to use our possessions to show that Jesus is our treasure. That means we ask ourselves, where does our money go? Does it go to Jesus? Does it go on ourselves? Do we give Jesus the first share? Or do we give our tithes to him? Or do we begrudge it? And why is it that God gives some people more money than they need? That applies to all of us, mostly. We have more money than we need. Why is it that God does that? Is it so that we can feather our own homes? Or is it that we can become imitators of God, like dearly loved children, and give generously to people around us, to be open-handed? And in doing so, we display that money isn't important to us. We display that God is the one in whom our trust lies to provide for our needs. And we also have the privilege of displaying God himself to those around us. So we should use our possessions to display to others that Jesus is our treasure. I'll finish just with John Wesley and his view of money. Wesley had more than enough to live on. and he spent his money this was in his early days as a student, on pictures and on paintings and to decorate his room. And he saw one of the maids coming in to clean his room, and it was a cold winter day, and she had nothing to protect her from the cold except a thin linen gown. And he reached into his pocket to give her something to buy a coat, and he found he had too little left. And he thought to himself, well, what will God say to me? Will my master say, well done, good and faithful steward? You have adorned the walls with the money which might have screened this poor creature from the cold. So it says in 1731, Wesley began to limit his expenses so that he would have more money to give. And he kept a record of what his income was and what he needed to live on. And when his income was £30, he found that his expenses were £28, so he gave the two away that were left over. The next year, his income doubled, and his income, or his expenses, finally, he could still live in 28. So he gave 32 away. Later on, his income had jumped to £90, and he was still living off 28. He was able to give 72 away. And so instead of letting his expenses rise with his income, he kept them low and was able to give away more and more. And Wesley says that it's not the... whenever our income increases, what should rise is not the Christian standard of living, but the Christian standard of giving. And as he came towards the end of his life, his income was over £1,400 and his expenses were just over £30. Still at that same level. And he was giving away nearly £1,400. He had no family to care for, no need of savings. It says here. And Wesley's guidelines were gain all you can, save all you can, give all you can. You see how God honoured that. And no one was in any doubt where Wesley's heart's treasure lay. So let's seek, when God has prospered us, to live in such a way that people around us can see that Jesus is our treasure and that we value him above everything else that we have.